Hello.
Dun 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 dun.
It's good.
Dun 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 dun.
It's a pretty good impression.
Da 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 da. Etc. So, how are you?
Good. I got my water here. Mm-hmm. It's very dry and warm outside. I was a little parched.
Mm-hmm. Just like the post-apocalypse.
Yeah, I think those people probably a little bit more thirsty than I am.
Mm. Yeah,
they weren't wearing their 2 million sunblock or whatever.
No, didn't appear so.
It's kind of dorky line, but she sells it pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, which is one of the impressive things about Linda Hamilton in this particular film. Not to mention, of course, her physical presence on the screen, which
it's very intimidating.
I'm scared of Linda Hamilton, but she does a much better job than you might think that she would do based on the prior film, because of how the character was written and what the character was supposed to be in the first film, and seeing what has transformed in the intervening time frame between that and this, and how the news of the future has altered and shaped the person that she's become. She does a good job. She does a really good job.
Yeah, and we piece together through exposition that she has ostensibly been radicalized by this news and gone on down to South America to run some guns and get ready and live a bit of a military lifestyle. But she hasn't lost her focus. She did come back and try to blow up a quote-unquote computer factory, as John calls it, which is presumably Cyberdyne.
Yes, I would assume that as well. They don't specifically call out Cyberdyne as the institution that she was going against, but it's pretty clear that she has a particular focus against that company. Because
and you would have thought she would have had a little bit more knowledge about Miles Dyson, but maybe she was coming at it from just an outside perspective of, like, that building needs to explode, not necessarily who's in charge of the building.
Well, it's not like it is these days where we have intimate knowledge of everybody who's working at Silicon Valley companies. Like, she doesn't have people on Twitter who work for BuzzFeed who are tweeting about every little thing that Miles Dyson might be doing.
You can't look up Miles Dyson's Twitter feed where it says husband, father, futurist, and cybernetic organism developer or something.
Yeah, no, that's not something that she can do. It's not at her it's not accessible to her, that kind of information. And you she's got to go off of what she has, which is apparently just like blind rage.
I mean, she could have, she's got a lot of that. Yeah. She could have just waited till the technology was available to realize her dream.
Yeah, she'll just wait until after the world is destroyed and then Twitter is invented. Because we should mention that the world is destroyed a little earlier than some people might think.
Oh, 1997?
I mean, remember when the world was annihilated in 1997?
I mean, to be honest, everything after 1997 was pretty terrible, so I think that's it's fine.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that you could probably very easily mock about this film is its depiction of the future. But like most things that are about the future, it's really about our present, because it has a message for us, the audience, which is
learn to love each other.
Don't blow ourselves up. Also don't let computers control everything, because they'll blow us up because we taught the computers. I don't know. It's basically peace, love, and happiness is what James Cameron is all about at the end of the day, when you really sit and think about his works.
I mean, it's really about the dangers of AI if we're boiling it down. Like, you know, it's a big responsibility to be creating this artificial intelligence if you don't put some fail-safes in place first. And even if you do, it could potentially circumvent them, much like a Terminator can reroute its power from an alternate source.
Yes, with a diagram that it can see, because it needs to see an overlay of what it is doing.
Look, I mean, some things are just for the audience. It's fine.
It's one of the things that really gets me about Terminator vision in the prior movie and in this one, is that whenever you see it, it's like, who is this information for? Like, if you're having these graphic overlays, it makes sense if it's like a drone or something and there's a human operator somewhere who needs to have this information along with the visual feed. But if it's a robot, it doesn't need to see the text that it has made for itself to see, you know? You follow where I'm coming from?
It doesn't
need to OCR what it is telling itself.
Sure. I mean, things like scanning the size of the bikers to see if their clothes will fit, like that's a visual thing that it's going to use its robot vision to do.
Yeah, but it doesn't need to draw like little grids of what those shapes are and then put little printouts of text strings and digits for it to read back to itself about that. It just knows it because it is the computer that is printing that.
Maybe doing that is the Terminator's way of creating what looks like involuntary eye darting, which is a very human characteristic because the robot is looking around and reading things in its eyes, and it helps it look more human.
Or maybe it's like when humans take notes. He's not printing it out to remember it later. He's
he's scanning it to remember it now. He's it's like when you look up to the corner, like up and to the right when you're thinking about something. Mm-hmm. It's a lot like that, except he's doing numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, of course, that it is a conceit of the medium in order to communicate to us, the audience, what the Terminator is thinking, because that is something that the audience otherwise would have no insight into, because we are not connected to his thoughts, so we need to see some representation of them. And so I can buy that. But it's one of the numerous conceits that you do have to go along with in the Terminator series. Another one is that the American computer system that has built infiltration robots has a fondness for Austrians, which is just a little odd.
Well, it probably has an incomplete record of what humanity was like before the nuclear holocaust. So it just picked a skin tone that matched a voice and was just like, yeah, sure, fine. I don't know what the percentage was, but probably like 70% of the people in America had this accent, so we'll just go with that.
Yes.
Or maybe the front of the war at this point is over in Europe, and they didn't really think about that when they built their Terminator factory there. Although I'm pretty sure from the other movies that we see that the factories are in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but maybe it's one of those EU regulations where you need to represent the EU culturally in what you're producing there. So it could be that they need to manufacture a certain percentage of Austrian robots.
Oh, right. It's like tax incentives for film. Like you have to hire a certain number of local crew for you to qualify. You can't just bring everyone from Los Angeles.
Exactly. Yeah. Like that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. No, obviously that's another conceit that we have to go along with as the audience, because that is Arnold Schwarzenegger. So here you go. Here is him. He is here. He talks like that.
It's fine. It works.
No, I mean, it's fine, except for like the parts where he's like talking about his perfect recollection and memory and stuff and his ability to impersonate all kinds of voices. And he settles on his default being an Austrian accent.
Maybe it's one of those ones where if his voice was too perfect and enunciated too well, he would stick out in a crowd. He needs some sort of like minor defect / affectation to blend in with the crowd. The melting pot that is the diverse United States of America.
Yes, this movie is all about melting pots. But speaking of blending in, Robert Patrick, for me, like you're saying, you can be too perfect and not blend in. And I feel like that's Robert Patrick, because like when he goes to talk to the parents at the beginning of the film, the foster parents, and he's like, no, I wouldn't worry about him. Yes. Okay. No, no trouble. Smile. Like It is something where the foster parents in the film could conceivably perceive that something is amiss. Because we as
he's
the audience...
He's also very casual with that unbuttoned shirt.
Well, it's Robert Patrick in the 90s. What are you going to do?
No, I like it because, you know, presumably, you know, they talk about in the first one how Arnold was an infiltration something or other where he's supposed to blend in. Like, maybe the T-1000s are built so cocky that like they don't have to worry about fitting in, because like they can just change their shape and hide, and like they're basically indestructible in most scenarios, so like they don't really have to worry about blending in. It's like, what are you gonna do? Are you gonna kill me? No, I'm just gonna slice your head off, so it's fine.
Yeah, and that's what happens with the newer generation, when they don't have the same, when they don't have the same problems to overcome that the previous generation did. That is something we see time and time again in history.
They don't know how to fit in with a crowd.
Yeah, he's the millennial of Terminators.
He's probably got like face tattoos that he just like morphed away or something. Like when he settles down at night to, you know, read a book and chill out and go to bed, like he turns back into his normal self, who's got a lot of piercings, a lot of ear gauges and face tattoos and things.
No, well, I mean, his normal self seems to be Robert Patrick, which is interesting because you would assume that it would be modeled off of like the first person he came into contact with or something, but the first person he comes into contact with doesn't look anything like Robert Patrick.
Ooh, maybe the one remaining human at the Terminator factory that's making the T-1000 experimental thingy-mabobs looks like Robert Patrick.
Maybe. What we really need is a story that's all about the Robert Patrick that inspired the Terminator who came back in time for this.
Well, they kind of did that with Salvation with Helena Bonham Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I saw that.
I don't...
No, it was...
No, I don't want them to do that, but
I mean, I might not have been sincere. That was... You know, just something I was saying.
It's hard to tell with you sometimes.
Yeah.
You're either completely sincere or not sincere at all. So you got to just pick one.
Mm-hmm. Maybe 50-50 shot. But Robert Patrick, this is, of course, a breakout role for him. And he's delivering his Robert Patrick-iness. And he does a very different Terminator from what Arnold does. But he's still... very robotic and Terminator-y. Like he's they're not human-ish.
I think he may sell the roboticness more than Arnold does. Mm-hmm. In his complete lack of unnecessary movement and emotion and just speech.
Yeah, and like you know the scene where he after the explosion of all the stuff that goes on at the end when they're getting out of Cyberdyne, and he. Goes up to the guy with the motorcycle. Not Cyberdyne. It was earlier than that. When
the asylum thing.
Yeah, when they escape the asylum, and he goes up to that guy, and he's like, nice bike, and he like turns his head to the side and back, and like really suspicious way. And it's like, yeah, you know, obviously you're gonna.
He's like, robot make human words now.
Yeah, it was. But I mean, I like it. I think. His performance is very good in this. It's just, it is definitely in no way a performance you would mistake for a human being in any regard.
But that's fine.
Yeah, no, I like it. I mean,
he's pretty great. He's got that creepy ass run too.
He does have an interesting run, and also his walk is fascinating. If you're just watching the way that he, I mean, it almost looks like he has like IK pops. IK, of course, for those listening, is
IK pops are a type of lollipop that you can buy in Costa Rica.
Yes. Most people don't like IK pops, but every now and then you see a few out there in the world.
The problem is because it's a band with like 30 people, so who do you actually root for? I think we've lost everyone.
This is so dumb.
Anyway, go back to explaining what IK actually is.
Inverse kinematics is how you do things that walk in computer graphics. You basically pick a point where you need to push off of stuff with like the leg. So like the pelvis is what's motivating the action, and the foot is sticking to the ground. And there is some poppiness that you might notice if you're watching the legs, where it goes completely 100% rigidly straight in a way that is unnatural, and sort of like snaps at the knee in a way that is unexpected. That's the best way I can sort of describe what to look for. It's basically just like a leg that is not correct, and then it like goes back to what it should be doing. And it's only like a frame that you'll notice that. That is why it is a pop.
It's probably also because he's got like the perfectly hemmed pants that have like no wrinkles in them, because they rest like just above his shoe, like they were literally just designed for part of his body.
Well, they are literally designed for part of his body. He does that.
Yeah. So on that note, why did he come through the portal naked? Not that it really matters.
I have, as we had learned from the first film, in its completely 100% factual scientific origins. Only living matter can go back in time. So how does that work with mimetic poly alloys exactly?
Well, it's yeah, because he's not living tissue over a metal exoskeleton. He's liquid metal slash. I don't know. What do you just like melt some aluminum and then like pour in some DNA and like stir it up?
I don't know. I mean, what if he was liquid metal inside of a Robert Patrick suit, and that's why he's naked when he comes back in time, and then he gets out of the Robert Patrick suit, and then he kills the other guy, and he has his police uniform.
Oh, so you think he has like a transport bag shaped like Robert Patrick?
Yeah, yeah. He just it's like a big onesie, Robert Patrick onesie. Well,
then why wouldn't they just put him in like a big flesh duffel bag?
I don't know. I mean, this is a question that I asked in the previous film where it's like, you know, they grill Reese about why they couldn't bring weapons back. And they're like, oh, you know, only living tissue can come back. And it's like, well, just done. And then you could bring that back. So I guess you could put a meat sleeve over your polymimetic alloy, blah, blah, blahs, and then bring them back.
No, I mean, they didn't have to do that. They found a way to make the weapon also the person, so like he is the weapon. He doesn't need to get weapons, which is also a pretty cool feature of him as a bad guy. Like, he doesn't have to like have that scene where he goes to the gun store to buy all the guns to help like defend himself or whatever. He's just like, I'm gonna make a bunch of big knives and slice people up with them.
I think that it is incredibly effective just physically, because he is able to pose a threat that other things were not able to. And we can see that guns have an impact on him in that they slow him down, but they do not stop him or cause him any permanent harm or damage. So it's interesting that people shoot at him a lot, and you get to see a lot of silver-painted latex blobs, but
and he'll fall down, like, presumably if you put a big enough hole in him, like, he has to reroute his power very quickly and then close up his hole, and then he can get back up, which is why he like lays on the ground for a while.
He's not going to die from any of those things, but he can be slowed long enough for people to get away, and that gives you dramatic chases. And because his weapons are all close range, it also makes the chase more dramatic, because it means that it's more of a threat the closer he gets to you, rather than he can just shoot at you from far away. So he's not really like trading shots with gunfire through this film. He's like running right up to the back of your car and just hooking himself into your trunk. So it's very interesting to watch that.
You know what he should do? He should turn one of his spiky arms into a throwing spear and then hook it at somebody.
The other thing.
With that very incredibly absurd camera angle where it comes flying right up to the lens from the top down. Yeah. And
I like, as we had discussed in the previous episode, I have not seen Terminator Genesis, and I have no immediate plans to, but I had seen a fragment of it, and it had included that that javelin toss. Which, yeah.
So speaking of other movies, my God, what I would give to be able to see this movie again without having any prior knowledge of it, because, like, the going into this movie in 1991 without having any expectations must have been mind blowing coming out of the theater seeing this, because it's so well done on so many levels. Like, I think. In the opening credits, the Linda Hamilton voiceover, doesn't she say, sent two back, one to protect him and one to like try and kill him or something? Like, I wish they would have left that out and left the audience to question whether or not Arnold was good up until the time when he actually
Do get some of that, because you don't know which one is the one who's there to protect him and which one is the one who's there to kill him. I mean, you can kind of intuit it from the fact that Arnold is procuring his clothes in a funnier fashion than Robert Patrick is.
Yeah, I guess we could have assumed that if he was the bad guy in the first one, maybe he's the bad guy in the second one. That would have been a reasonable
assumption.
That's obviously
the assumption that Linda Hamilton makes when she loses it in slow-mo.
Well, she doesn't know that there's two, because they don't, and the photos presented from the mall just show.
Yes, exactly. But she, like the audience, doesn't know that he is good. The audience already at that point, of course, knows. But that is that is something where I can see it being surprising, but like you, I can't wipe that from my memory. I can only know how that is going to come out, because I can only see the good guy Terminator that is Arnold Schwarzenegger in this one, and not the evil threatening one. And of course, you already know that Robert Patrick is evil, because he's... Yeah.
His face?
I mean, not to be too judgy, but he's playing it in such a way that there is no possibility that he's a good guy.
I also like it, like, compared to the first movie, that wasted a lot of time going, like, I'm going to go find a phone book and find all the Sarah Connors. Like, he manages to find a cop car immediately. He's like, oh, right, computer. I can just look up John Connor and figure out exactly where he is. Just go
they
right
are
to that
much
one.
Better at infiltration in this one. Although, I do have some questions about their plan of I will drive around Reseda until I find John Connor. But somehow that works because they find him at the mall, both of them, nearly at the same time.
Well, he's doing the legwork. He's saying, you know, any little kid his age he sees, he says, do you know John Connor? And he's going to find somebody who knows him, because back in the 90s, people actually knew their neighbors.
I don't know
about
that one. I avoided my neighbors. But he does have a photo, which makes that easier. And he has the guy from Salute Your Shorts as his friend who deflects for him. So he's there.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Camp, the I don't want to hold it in our hearts. And when we think about you, it makes me want to... Anyway.
I recognized him. I hadn't remembered that that's where I...
Yeah. But he's not in much of this, because after the arcade, he's gone. But...
Probably yeah. Better for him. You happen to see the quick comment in the chat, by the way, about your favorite addition to the movie, Bad to the Bone. Apparently, Cameron wasn't a big fan of it because it goes against the attempts to keep the who's good and bad mystery alive.
Oh, I had not noticed that people were typing things. But
yeah, there's people in the chat. Listening.
Surprising. Don't you guys have anything better to do on a Friday night? Come on.
they like you.
No, but I wonder who insisted on adding Bad to the Bone. But that is one of those things that I completely forgot was in the film until I was watching it the other day, and I was just like, what is happening? it's a little on the nose, as they say.
I think that scene is pretty good at setting Arnold up as because I think I complained a little bit in the first movie about the level of strength being inconsistent amongst them. I think in this movie they're both very consistent with their levels of strength and impenetrability with, you know, fighting and that sort of thing. And I think that scene does a really good job of just setting him up as like what he doesn't even need to worry about dealing with, because he's
yes,
a robot.
I would agree with that. They are much more consistent with this, and they do a better job shooting it for the most part. There are a couple of things, like in the ward at the mental institution, he like grabs one guy and pushes him through a door, and it's obvious that the guy is like pushing himself off the ground with his own 2 feet.
There are a lot of body tosses that are very clearly like on the cut and jump.
Yeah, so it's not perfect, but it's not as bad as, you know, in Terminator 3 when he gets his stuff to wear and he has the star sunglasses to put on instead of these sunglasses.
There's star sunglasses.
Yes, they're star shaped. There is
like Elton John glasses.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Rise of the Machines not very good, but surprise. James Cameron is much better at walking the line of comedy and seriousness than I feel like a lot of people give him credit for, because he's able to have moments of some levity, but nothing here especially stands out as being too broad. There's stuff that's been cut from the film that was much broader. Like there's a scene where Furlong is teaching our Terminator to smile.
I've seen that gif, and I'm happy that it's not in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. That's too broad. That's it works against your purposes of the film.
Is that in the special edition or just director's cut or what?
I don't know exactly where it resides, but it probably isn't maybe the special. There is some other stuff, like when the T-1000 is malfunctioning towards the end of the film, he starts to blend in with everything he's touching, and that looks a little cartoony and silly as well. There's one like really good scene that took them a long time to make, which is not funny or broad, which is sort of a shame that it's out. And that is when they have the Terminator, they deactivate him to take the chip out and change it, switch it over to being able to learn. But he's completely deactivated, and Linda Hamilton is going to smash the chip with a sledgehammer so that way they can be rid of him. And Eddie Furlong intervenes and stops her from doing that, and then they put the chip back in and reboot him. And there's a really complicated way of doing that where they constructed a second set, and they had Linda Hamilton's twin sister on the other side of the set because they wanted to have a camera move where otherwise you would have seen the camera, but they didn't want to do that. So there's two sets with two people practicing exactly the same motions at the same time.
I don't know this thing here. Is this a deleted scene or is this in one of the versions?
It's deleted, but it is, I think, in the special edition. It's serious. It's not broad. And
oh, just sound dumb is what I'm saying.
Oh, no, but it is interesting to watch, and it obviously took them a lot of time to do it, and it was supposed to be a story point, but they decided that, you know, we didn't really need it, and so it was gone.
Yeah, I agree they don't need it. I think there's even other things in the movie that they could remove and still let it go to the audience's imagination. Like, that opening voiceover is an easy one to, you know, take out who's good, who's bad. Like, you don't even need to say one's good, one's bad. They could both be bad. Like, you know, one failed last time, send two this time that are both bad. Like, you never know what they're doing. And then the other one is her, like,
yeah,
internal
one,
monologue.
One is none.
Yeah, exactly. Terminators or iPads. the other one is when she's, like, watching John teach him how to play high five, and she's like, ah, the father figure that's always going to be there turns out to be a robot. And it's like, I don't need that. I can get that from her staring at the Terminator and just kind of like being in awe of the fact that he's a good role model slash.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's not really the father kind of. John's kind of being the father to the childlike Terminator, but still it works.
I would like to have all of her voiceover removed. I understand why it's there. Because this is supposed to be an action movie that appeals to a broad audience. It is not niche. That is, you know, just for the real thinkers in the crowd. But and the first movie had not been that popular, so not everyone would know the story about what had happened in the first film. So you got to give them some setup, I guess. And so that's why you have the first thing. But definitely that second one where she's like, this is the father figure that I had been searching for. He would never leave him. He would never be upset with him. Blah, 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 blah. Like, that the whole thing can just leave. That can be gone. We can get that it's ironic from, you know, the way she's dealing with him.
Not even that it's ironic. It's just like, how messed up is this right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is it. There's also another thing that was deleted from the movie, which is a scene of Michael Biehn as Kyle Reese, who appears in a dream when she's still inside the ward, inside of her cell before she breaks out.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. It's very weird.
Yeah. So one of the big scenes with her is like her trying to manipulate psycho doctor guy by saying she's all better now, and they're showing her the video of her old self rambling on about her dreams about the end of the world that she has every night, and then the Terminators and all that stuff. But like, why does she have such vivid dreams of the future? Because it's almost like she has like ESP or something, or maybe Kyle's very descriptive stories were enough to stick with her, and she just is repeating that word for word. But it's just like she's having these very vivid dreams and like reciting them like they are truth. It's like, no, it's still like, sure, yeah, people are gonna die, whatever, there's gonna be bombs going off, but like it's just dream.
Yeah. So see, here's the thing. She is both correct and also mentally unstable and needs to be inside of an institution because she cannot deal with the trauma that she has been through, but she is not getting suitable counseling in order for her to process what she has been through in a way that is constructive.
Which, that's an interesting difference in a movie where they would just go like, see, I told you I was right all along. No, she is actually unstable because she has been through some serious trauma.
Yeah, no, she's totally been through trauma and she is unstable. Like she leaves her son to go murder the person who's going to build the computer that's going to do all of this. So she's,
and her escape plan involves putting a needle full of Drano in some guy's neck and just threatening to push the plunger. Like, no, it's already in his neck. What are you doing?
Yeah, she's...
Also, you can't put a 4-inch needle in somebody's neck right there and not cause some serious spinal damage.
She's just not... She is definitely disturbed in a way that she does need actual, genuine help. It is just that Dr. Silberman is not that help. Dr. Silberman is very uninterested in the things that she is saying because to him, she is more interesting as like a case study in psychosis than as someone he wishes to put back into the world. Like he is not doing anything to really benefit her.
Don't think he has any interest in her getting better because then he wouldn't be able to study and mock her.
Yeah, which is where the first scene we get of him is literally that, him going on a tour and introducing the people on the tour to this really fascinating person with this psychosis that he wants to sort of brag about how serious it is. Like he's very invested in her staying there as something for him to study and mock and to point out to other people. He's uninterested in doing anything that would benefit her. It goes beyond just him not believing her when she says that I'm all better now. You can send me out into the world. I'm a model citizen. Like even in spite of all of that, he has no intention of helping her at all. And so it is a situation where we can cheer her on for wanting to get out of that, but at the same time, we can lament the fact that she is screwy, that she's totally traumatized by what she's been through in her life, and no one is ever going to be able to help her with this, and that years of untreated trauma have just accumulated into these horrible dreams that she's having. Yeah.
But now she's also really strong, and she's going to stab you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she's got to defend herself from the robots when they destroy everything. Mm-hmm.
She's good.
Yeah. Linda Hamilton's good in this. Very good. Did you ever see the Terminator 3D Universal Studios thing?
I want to say yes.
I mean, I saw it at the Universal Studios one. I think they had it out here at the Hollywood one, but I wasn't here at the time. And many years ago, it was decommissioned and I think turned into like a Simpsons ride or something. But it is...
I played a lot of the video game at the arcade where you had the gun and you were running around shooting Terminators.
Well, for this one, they actually had James Cameron film stuff in 3D of Sarah Connor and played by Linda Hamilton and Eddie Furlong reprising his role as John Connor, going into the future to stop the T-1 million in Skynet, that they still did their thing.
They went from 101 to 1,000 to 1 million. That's a pretty big jump.
Yeah.
Someone should tell Skynet that that's not how you version projects.
You just put a zero on the end. Yeah, that's apparently what had happened to T-1 million. I think it just sounds more impressive than the T-1001, but it was basically just the T-1001 because it was just like a liquid metal spider.
It was a spider?
Well, sort of spider shaped. Yeah.
I mean, why would you need a new version to do that? Like Robert Patrick could do that.
Well, it was guarding the Skynet core thing. I'm trying to remember. This is all from memory, of course, from like 20 years ago. So,
well, I expect you to have the details down exact as they were.
That's the best I can do right now. But it was not very good. But it was surprisingly immersive for the time, I guess, because you're wearing these 3D glasses and watching the 3D stuff, and it is, of course, the not anaglyph, like 3D nowadays kind of a thing. You had the sort of robot puppets that came up on these stands on the side that sort of looked like primitive versions of the Terminator robots that you see in the future in this one.
Yeah, I totally remember this. I just don't remember the story of the thing. I've been to this, whatever this is.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I would assume so, because you were a child of the 90s. But it was a weird thing, and obviously it has no enduring staying power or anything, unlike the film, but it's curious to see that that is a thing that had existed in time, and it had all of the principal people involved in it when they made it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so let's talk about the plan for the movie that then changes into a different plan. So their plan is to just like book it south and hide from the T-1000 because there's really no way that it could find them if they just like hid in South America for the rest of their lives.
Well, it seems that way.
At least they're going to go hide long enough until they can regroup, but they don't really need to get very far before they figure out what their plan is.
Well, I mean, part of it is to get away from the city, somewhere where there's less interaction with other humans, so that it is more difficult to track you.
And maybe get out of the immediate blast zone, so they're survivors of the nuclear holocaust in 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's 6 years off. They can take the time, can walk. But it is primarily about not being found by this other thing and not having as many people around you who could surprise be it a T-1000. That's why it's good to go to the desert.
I wonder if the T-1000 could turn one of his fingers into like a Cat5 connector and plug into the internet and like find people.
It doesn't appear that seems to be how he approaches using computers in this, because he just types on the
thing. Maybe once AOL became a thing, he could get online.
Well, I think you're thinking of Terminator 3: Rise of the Machines, where what's your face can interact with any piece of electronics, including trucks. And control them.
Right. No, I'm.
Remember the part where she uses trucks, which don't have digital driving any things to do that.
Yeah, but you can do radio frequencies, pulse, like electric pulses over the air. It's totally the same thing. No, I was thinking more like the T-1000 could jack into a bunch of CCTV cameras and like track them, even if they were like not interacting with people. But just smashing people with trucks is good too.
Yeah.
Especially if you're in a leather jumpsuit with a ponytail. Very discreet.
We'll never ever get to that movie, but
I feel like we should watch, we should take a month and just watch the awful abortive sequels of the Terminator franchise, just because they are so stupid.
They're really bad.
They take everything you love about this movie and then just like crap all over it. Like, what I love about this movie is it is not full of like they hop in a car and then it all tilts to one side. They're like, whoa, look how heavy you are, Arnold, because you're made out of metal. Get it? Remember? Mm-hmm. You're a robot. Like, how funny is that? It's like, we don't. Wait, look at you. You can't smile because you're a robot and you don't know how human emotion. Like, there's a little bit of like the training trying to like help him be a little bit more human, but it's not like a Men Are From Mars, Robots Are From Venus kind of like, let's figure out how to speak each other's language kind of crap.
Mm-mm.
But all the other movies are just like, let's explore the world of the Terminator. Imagine you put a robot in humanity. Like, imagine all the weird things. Like, he would try to sit down on a bed and it would break because he's so heavy. It's like, yeah, all right, whatever. Anyway, this movie, Terminator 2, is incredibly economical in terms of not screwing about with, like, let's just wander around a scene and explore things for a while. They go from, like, A to B to C very quickly, and they abide by their own rules, and it's very consistent, and it's good action, it's well shot, and it's all just good.
Yeah. And this is a movie where the sequel eclipses the original, in my opinion. I feel like
the sequel eclipses most movies first, the most franchises first movie.
Yeah, but especially in particular, Terminator for this one. Like if you watch, like I did, and I don't know if this was the same for you. I saw I think Terminator 2 first before I saw Terminator, and if you see Terminator 2, and then you go watch Terminator, it's just like, wait, what? Like how did that happen? Like how do you even connect these things? They just feel like such different films in terms of execution and quality of what you see on the screen before you. It is not even like a case of like the writing being a little different or something. Like it is just all out a totally different beast, which is strange because it's the same cinematographer. It's the same guy doing the score. We got Brad Fidel back. We got James Cameron directing both of these. They're not that terribly far apart in terms of years. They're not, you know, like close together, but they're not, there's nothing like crazy. It's not even a full decade between them.
I mean, you can grow as a filmmaker in 7 years, a pretty far, I imagine. But I mean, they had the money and the resources and the support to say like, all right, everyone, like bring your A game, I guess.
Which is strange, because if you saw the first one and you had that knowledge going into making the sequel, you'd be like, well, why do I need to bring my A-game? You know?
Well, yeah, I mean...
How were you convinced to bring your A-game to this?
I think giving Arnold the time and the... I don't know, sort of the environment and the scenes to allow him to, like... be more of the Terminator, because he does, in the sequels he is much worse at actually looking like a robot. In this movie he manages to both look like a robot and blend in kind of at the same time, and there are a lot of opportunities for him to screw that up, just blinking or sniffing at the wrong time, or you know, just making a face or something. Like I kind of wish there were a couple of instances in this movie where he does like the little like half knowing smile or whatever. It's like, I know he learned that from Furlong or whatever, but I kind of wished like he wouldn't have done that. He'd just be a little bit more unfeeling. But like he really manages to like dial in every bit of it. Maybe it's just like, all right, that was good. We need to make sure you keep your eye line here. Don't blink. Like when you turn this way, it looks a little too human. Like that would be the only thing I can think to give him the opportunity to just perfect it in terms of like dialing things up and down just ever so slightly.
Maybe. But I mean, I can understand why you could probably sell Arnold on coming back to do this, because he would have the ability to be a character now that you're going to give him this whole story about having a learning chip so that he can become, that he can act more human-ish instead of being such a dork all the time. And
I mean, he also he's at the behest of the Connors, so he has to provide answers and input and back and forth because he's taking orders as well.
Right. Which is also, I think, a weird scene where he finds out that he can give Arnold orders because Arnold told him no, and then all of a sudden he puts him down and he's like, why'd you do that? And he said, oh, because you ordered me. And it's like, well, he was ordering you like a second ago to go save his mom, and you just didn't do that because he didn't use the word order.
You didn't phrase your order in the form of a question or something.
Syntax error.
Exactly. Yeah. You forgot the semicolon.
Yeah, no, it was supposed to be dash dash help, not dash help error. So please retype that.
See, it's a Unix system. You got to do it correctly. But then once you're in, you know the commands.
The Unix system. I know this. It's interesting that he gets to sort of be a character that wasn't really a character at all in the first one. And I can understand why that would be more appealing to him. And Linda Hamilton, likewise, she's not screaming and running for her life and being dragged around from scene to scene by Michael Biehn. She's very motivated and very she has a lot of agency. Let's just say that. Maybe some would say too much.
She's beating up and killing more people than the Terminators are.
Yeah, she's got a lot going on. Contrast that with what she did in the first one. So obviously for her, she was you know, going to be interested in doing this because she was going to have that that input into being able to do these things. So it is good that they were able to transform these characters so that they would be better in the sequel, because both of them were flat in the first one, because Arnold isn't really a character. He is a force of unnature, and Linda Hamilton isn't really a character as much as she is screaming and being dragged from scene to scene by Michael Biehn, who is also not really a character. There's not really a lot of like fully fleshed out characters in that first one.
Yeah. And interestingly, as sort of like borderline unbalanced as she is in this movie, she is incredibly dedicated to what she knows to be true and what she knows needs to be done. So that really gives her a goal and a drive from scene to scene to really like sink her teeth into and become the Sarah Connor. And, you know, even when she goes off the deep end a little bit and starts accusing Miles Dyson of being like the people who created the atomic bomb and all that stuff too, like she's still very, she's buying into her own psyche pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we even had Dr. Peter Silberman reprising his role as Dr. Peter Silberman from the first film. And he's delivering an actual performance this time. And he is more thoroughly fleshed out than he was in the first one. Like he's not a good guy, and I don't like him by any stretch of the imagination, but he's certainly interesting to watch on screen, whereas in the first one he's very perfunctory. Like he's just there to be like, yeah, she's nuts, and then that's it.
I love the restraint in his scene too, where he actually, like in the sequel of this movie, when what did you call him, a franchise sequel?
Yes, yeah, a franchise sequel.
When Robert Patrick morphs through the bars with the gun and does his thing, he would walk past a psych guy who was up against the wall there and like turn and stare him down and give him a, yeah, that's right, I'm a robot from the future look, and then like run on. And then Dr. Silberman would get another close up where he's like, F me, I guess I'm the jerk in this situation. But it's like, no, he just runs right past and starts shooting at Arnold, and we never even see the doctor again because he's not important. But to resist that urge, it is so correct, but would be so hard to do for somebody who is a fan of this franchise in this world.
Yeah, I mean, he does get an amazing reaction shot, though, when Robert Patrick goes to the bar and his the little cap that he has in his mouth falls out.
Yeah,
I love that. I love that shot. There is a GIF on the internet that I had found years ago, I guess, I remember fondly. Where there's somebody who cut that scene, instead of taking the Robert Patrick part, they removed that and replaced it with a Pomeranian who's walking through a small gate. And the Pomeranian is, of course, just a little fluff ball, so it sort of like morphs through the thing because its fluff is pushed back by the little bars. I think it's funny because then you cut back to the reaction shot of Dr. Silberman dropping the little cap. it just makes me laugh. It makes me laugh so much.
Pomeranians are the real Terminators.
Yeah.
They'll kill you with kindness.
And that smile, they're so cute. I mean, I know it's not actually like a smile, that's just what their face looks like, but it's adorable. They're cute.
Dog smile. Yeah. Like when we take our dog for a walk, he has a visible smile compared to the rest of his faces.
Yeah, but I would say like Pomeranians and like Corgis, it's like they're smiling.
Yeah, it's kind of their default face.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, kind of sad, I guess, cuz maybe they're just like constantly in pain and agony and hate life, but they can't show it.
Life is pain, help me, smile.
Yeah. That's a pleasant thought, but I love in particular that scene, and we should probably talk about the effects on this, because on occasion you and I both do things that involve effects, and I have to imagine that what you saw here when you were a kid was influential in you and your choices as an adult. And that's why everything you make now has liquid metal in it.
For a long time, like the only six-step Photoshop effect that I had memorized that I learned out of like Photoshop World magazine was how to create cool, realistic-looking Chrome text. So I'll give you that, probably. You do some stuff with lighting effects and curves. It's really cool. Anyway, yeah, I don't know. I mean, the effects in this movie, again, like the previous movie, they had a much bigger budget too, but he planned the sequences for the effects. And you can see him using like every trick in the book. Like sometimes they're just hiding an arm behind their back. Sometimes it's CG. Sometimes it's a puppet. Like they use all of their available resources to cut together a scene out of all of the different pieces, and it works and it's believable because, you know, presumably people watching this in 1991, they don't know which gag there is happening at a given time. So it allows you to suspend your disbelief even further and just go with it. And it's cool.
Yeah. And I would say that not all of this holds up. And by any stretch, I would say most of it is very obvious what is not photographically real, but
oh, yeah, you can totally see what it is now. Yeah.
But the intention behind everything they did is good, and I respect everything, all the choices that they had made in what they were producing.
Totally. You can be like, yeah, that's an Arnold stunt double on that motorcycle, but who cares? It's close enough. And then you cut to the close-up, and it's Arnold again.
Yeah. Or like that scene where the T-1000 is walking out of the fire with the truck explosion that's inside of the runoff thing.
Mm-hmm. I stared at that one a little harder this time too, to try and get a look at it. It's like, oh yeah, I guess he just sort of emerged from the fire.
Yeah, it's not how you would do that nowadays, that's for sure. Because
there's no simulation of him like moving the fire out of the way, but the fire looks real because it's real.
Yes, the fire is very real.
Actually, the other one that I really love is when he's the fat cop or whatever walking down the hallway, and then the camera like pans a little bit and then pans back, and then suddenly he's Robert Patrick, and it's like, oh, he was just walking on. He was just behind the camera, and then like when they panned, they like switched out real fast. Now he's just walking again.
Yes, yes,
it's great.
It's movie magic. A very inexpensive
it's
movie
the
magic.
Cheapest, dumbest trick in the book. Whereas again, nowadays people be like, "No, I need to see that morphin camera." Well, why? Well, because it turns me on.
Well, I would say that there's definitely a flaw of modern movie making, is that oftentimes we forget about the tricks, and that people just believe that they need to see everything all the time. And even the filmmakers of yesteryear who did these tricks, what, now that they have the technology, many of them have fallen victim to the belief that they need to show everything in camera now.
I mean, like right down to the point where it's like she's got her paper clips and she's picking the lock. Anyone watching that, if she picks that lock in like 30 seconds, they're going to go like, that's not believable. You know what's believable? Cut away. Don't even show her opening the door. And then you just get the part where she's got the broomstick and hits the guy in the face.
Yeah. Like, well, that's another good thing about this. Editing. Editing is important, and that's why you should have good editors, and you should have probably, I guess, three different people editing this. It's a lot of film to go through, but
shooting this on film.
Well, I mean, it was the style of the time, but
it was the technology of the time.
Yeah, there was no digital camera that you were going to shoot this with. Having said that, this film looks remarkably clean and in good condition for when it was shot in 1991. There's other things that I have seen that have, you know, like as we discussed, film grain that is atrocious, or lens artifacts that are gross. But this movie is very, I would say, pristine, almost sterile. But it should be, because it's about robots.
It's even pretty like bland in terms of like cinematography, right up until you get to that end scene where everything is red and blue and high contrast and stuff. Like for the most part, it's pretty natural looking.
Yeah, well, especially when they go to Dyson's house, if you watch that scene in particular, everything seems overly lit and very flat and TV movie-esque, I would say, almost.
Except his office, where the action is actually going to happen, because that can be blue.
Yes, exactly. But the part in the living room where they have the confrontation and Sarah Connor's pulled back and stuff like that, that is totally overlit. For what's going on, and there's no real shape or direction that you're seeing anywhere. Also, another thing that you should make a key point of this film, like many other films of the era, nighttime is blue, and not just like a little bluish. I mean, blue, like super blue, a lot of times, especially in your rear projection driving shots.
Okay, that scene was bad.
It's
when they first get Sarah out of the asylum, and they're in the whichever car that was. That
the police car.
Was that the, that was the police car, not the station wagon?
They ditched the police car for the station wagon at the gas station repair shop thing.
Yeah, there's a few shots there that are just like, shake the camera because the car is not moving and we have a big screen showing windy road footage behind it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, I wonder if that was like reshoots because, like you said, they had this big long scene where they replaced his CPU. Because I think that's the scene where he says something about being a neural net processor or something. Maybe I'm misremembering where that took place, but I feel like that was the scene where he said, like, yeah, I can learn stuff.
I thought he said that in the auto shop, but it does. I mean, it doesn't matter. That scene is just a little weird for those reasons that we have outlined. It's not, it is certainly not the worst rear projection stuff I've ever seen, but it's not,
it's not anywhere near the best.
No,
but it does stick out in a movie that cost $100+ million.
Yeah, I mean, I really question I question the need to film that scene in that way, because at night you should not really see all that much outside of the window. Yeah, like there's a problem sometimes that these things fall victim to. Like when we talk about Predator 2 and they're supposed to be inside that warehouse where nobody can see anything because it's so dark, but we as the audience see everything because they've lit it all with blue lights. It's very obvious where everything is. So there's no drama for us as the audience. We're just watching people who say they can't see anything stumble around in the dark. And it's sort of like the same thing with this car thing. Is like, yeah, they turned off all their lights and they're driving through the woods in the middle of the night, but you can see individual tree branches and stuff because they're illuminated by day for night rear projection photography that's behind them, which is surprising to say the least. Like, you just make it black back there. Nobody needs to see anything. Some vague shapes.
Egg shapes?
Vague shapes.
I got you.
Vague.
Yeah, but yeah, other than the rear projection scene, there are two sequences with some puppets that are still not the best, but pretty good, ish.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to the other movie, the cop who gets the spike through the eye, who is a twin, and that's how they did those scenes, is twin dude. He's been in other things with his twin. When he's got the spike in his eye, he's very clearly like a Halloween prop.
Yeah. Also, like you said, a couple of the Schwarzeneggers. Not as bad as that scene with Arnold
cutting his eye open. Yeah. In the other one. Yeah. Not nearly that bad. Yeah. That was
his Unchien and Delu and scene. So
yeah, they took all the bad flop sweat from Terminator 1 and gave it to Miles Dyson in this movie.
I mean, he does a good job with having some like I'm dying pallor.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's probably just because he's not used to having such massive surges of adrenaline all the time. Mm-hmm. That as soon as
sedentary lifestyle that he has,
he sits behind a computer. As soon as he gets one bullet in his shoulder, suddenly he's sweating bullets.
Yeah. Well, you gotta get the bullets out of you. And the only way to do that is sweat the bullets.
Yeah, you know, you don't want medicine or anything. He's a naturalist, so rather than actually like go to the doctor, he just sweats his bullets out.
Well, it's all about diluting the bullets with sweat, because the sweat is water, so it's just homeopathy. Simple science.
Yeah, if you get shot, just drink lots of water. Just drink lots of water, sweat it out, you'll be good to go.
Yeah. Thank you, and welcome to our completely factual science podcast, where we talk about surviving bullet shots. So, anyway...
All you gotta do is tie a jacket around your leg, and you're fine.
Oh, man, you can walk on it in no time. this film. Okay, so
this movie does rely heavily on the was a 40mm grenade launcher doodad.
There are a lot of grenades.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just thinking there are no handheld like tossable grenades, because those would have come in handy in a couple instances in this movie, but it's just the rocket launched or the rifle launched grenades or whatever. But that's that's pretty cool.
Isn't it technically like an RPG? No, that's not, because that's the one that looks like a bazooka.
Right, it's not rocket propelled. It's just sort of small explosive behind it fires it out.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a gunologist, but so they have the let's just skip through the stuff. There's basically like three acts to this movie. There's the first act where they set everything up. Then there's a second act where they've escaped the mental institution and they're on the run to go south. And they are regrouping at the auto mechanic thing. And then they go to the south and meet up with Enrique and his family. And they get the weapons cache, etc. And then there's the third act
Sarah
where...
Sarah Connor pretends like she speaks Spanish.
And then there's the third act where... Linda Hamilton is going to go stop the machines and stuff, and then they decide that, oh no, I can't kill this guy, it's wrong, he has a kid and he has a family too, I'm just as bad as the Terminators are because I'm going to try to stop the future by killing somebody in the past to prevent something, you know, blah 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 blah, mental mind job thing.
At least there was no, like, Edward Furlong running in when she's about to shoot him and go, like, how many people could you kill to save the world, man? You're just as bad as the machines. Again, restraint. Appreciate that. We get the subtext without needing to have it explained to us.
Yeah. But then they divert from that to Miles Dyson being very understanding of the scenario that he had found himself inside of, where he had previously been shot at by these people, and now he's going to go with them to his office on a mission to destroy everything that he's ever done, because he saw Arnold peel off the skin on his robot arm.
And Arnold gives him the rundown, the timeline, storyline about what happened and why it's his fault.
Yeah, I mean, they have a moment of exposition, voiceover stuff while Arnold has presumably been talking for, like, I don't know, hours. But they still follow through with this plan. It just seems, in the pace of this film, I find it a little weird how comfortable Dyson gets with being an insurgent physically in this process. But anyway, they go to the facility, they tape up the security guard guy, they go up to the place, and then the other security guard guy finds that security guard guy and pushes the silent alarm. And then Dyson points at the screen and says, they pushed the silent alarm. And then he points to the other screen where there's another thing that says silent alarm. But so it's not really super beneficial as a silent alarm if you have, like, several CRT monitors that all display silent alarms.
Well, presumably the people who are normally up there are people who would want to know that an alarm has been set off.
Yeah, but that's why you would have a silent alarm. Like, if you're making that argument, it would be an alarm up there.
Well, I mean, there's a little bit of mixed geography. They mentioned that there's a security station up there, and that's where they go to get the key. So I think that's where they are. They're not just, like, hanging out amongst the cubicles, and there's CRTs littered about the place with silent alarm triggers on them.
I just feel like that's a little unnecessary. They could have just been like, oh, shoot, it's the cops.
Least we don't linger on it. We don't get a full, like, extreme close-up of the CRT showing it. I praise the restraint, because there are so many, like, props and set pieces in this movie that would just be so wonderful to just sit on and admire for a while and just, like, look how cool this thing is that we made. But he just, like, nope, we got things to go see, people to blow up, that kind of stuff, and it's just moving on.
Yeah. James Cameron certainly is not Michael Bay, I will say that.
And yet, you know, he's got his slow-mo moments, which, I don't know, there's probably like three or four of them in the movie. They're not extreme slow-mo.
There's more slow-mo than that, but it just feels like there's only a few because he does it so well. I would take James Cameron slow-mo over Michael Bay, Zack Snyder slow-mo any day of the week.
Yeah, because that is just like somebody is flying through the air because they were blown up, and somebody in the foreground is screaming in slow motion. Not so much like, this is a dramatic emotional moment because Sarah Connor thinks she's running towards an elevator and out steps a Terminator that she doesn't know is good, and she starts freaking out. It's like, that is a perfect moment to use slow motion.
Yes, exactly that. You remember it as being slow motion, but it feels appropriate because the emotion is appropriate. And then in Michael Bay or Zack Snyder films, there is no emotional connection. It's because there is action that is occurring and they want to see the action.
I remember that one from Transformers, where one Transformer is doing like a cartwheel over top some lady who is not in the rest of the movie, and then something explodes.
Yeah, because he wanted to see the action. Not because of the emotion, just to see the action. So it's a totally different thought process behind the deployment of slow motion in these films.
I think people got ruined by Bullet Time, because Bullet Time and The Matrix kind of had a story point. Well, it definitely had a story point, but people saw that and they're like, yeah, let's slow down the action and see how cool it looks when you're going, you know, so slow. And it's like, well, it's, there's no point to it, but sure, go right on ahead.
Yeah, and then, you know, you, with Zack Snyder, you get speed ramps. Like, there are, we've mentioned that I've worked on Watchmen in the past. There are some parts of Watchmen that I'm not a super huge fan of, and one of them is in the prison break scene where you got the owl dude, Billy Crudup. He wasn't the owl. Billy Crudup was Watch. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
It was the blue guy. Wait, yeah. The owl guy is it? Wait, and where? What?
Yeah, the owl guy and the blue guy. But so the owl guy, he goes to punch some of the people, and he's like flying through the air, and then it slows down, and he punches, and then it speeds back up again. And it's like, why did you do that? Like,
because oh, it looks cool.
Well, but it doesn't look it really. Like if you watch the shot, it's not like, oh wow. It's like,
oh yeah, it's a punch.
It's yeah, it's a punch. So it's just.
Well, doesn't he jump up in the air and like his cape is flowing and stuff too?
Yeah. I mean, flowing. it's one of those things where it's like I can understand and respect wanting to see things in slow motion, but at the same time, I feel like there needs to be an emotional resonance to that. It's not because we don't need to see things in slow motion just because we need to see them like perfectly crisp on the screen to understand what is happening. Like a punch. I feel like this movie is much better at the use of slow motion for emotional effect than other films are.
I would agree.
Yes. In the third act of this, they blow the crap out of Cyberdyne, and there's a big scene of Arnold blowing up all those cop cars. There's a lot of explosion and destruction stuff that occurs, and a lot of it is just very practical because that's how you did it.
Although it's actually kind of hilarious, like how quickly he breezes past the one major explosion where they blew up the building, because they're already gone. Like the characters have left the building, and it's just like all the cops hanging out now.
Yeah, but the one of the things that I do like about this film in particular is that. John Connor makes it a point that it is wrong to kill people. So actually the body count in this film is surprisingly low, even though there is a ton of violence and destruction. It's not like the first film where he's like wasting all of the cops, most of them off camera. It still has the action element of these explosions and the destruction, and these cops feel like they are in peril. So it feels like there is stuff happening, but we know that this Terminator is trying not to kill anybody, but to drive them away. Unfortunately, this has the unintended consequence of upping the stakes for the police, so they automatically break into the building shooting, which is why an unarmed guy gets shot. Several times with a lot of bullets and falls to the ground. So yeah.
Well, that also probably has the unintended consequence of permanently changing the landscape of filmmaking such that gratuitous violence is allowed, although as long as you don't say any naughty words or show anyone naked.
I feel like that happened before this film. But
just, you know, the success of this, nobody got killed. Everybody was happy. The guy he shot in the legs will live. Like he'll be fine.
I mean,
well, not fine, but he'll be alive.
There's still people who died in this, though.
Yeah. Two bullets in the shins is probably not going to lead to a super fulfilling life for the rest of your... I don't know. He looked like an older gentleman, too.
Yeah, I can't imagine it was, you know, just all you know, wine and roses for him. But it's basically the end game now. They get out of Cyberdyne, but at a tremendous cost. They've lost Miles. They
tremendous cost to who?
Well, they lost Miles. They've shot up their Terminator. He is full of bullets now and severely damaged. Still functional, but damaged.
He doesn't rot nearly as quickly as the one from Terminator 1.
No, well, I mean that took place over more time than this film takes place over with the damage that he has incurred. Although I do have to question, like, what was their long-term plan for cutting off Arnold's arm meat? Because
he just kind of like put it back on and like stapled it and then covered it with a glove.
Did he?
I mean, he covered it with a glove, so I assume he put it back on. Otherwise, it would just kind of be a pretty hollow glove.
Yeah. No, Hollow Glove is the name of my band that will be performing at Coachella.
I feel like we're
from Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like he probably has some sort of, because he sews up miles. He probably, you know, does a quick sew up to keep the meat sack around his arm.
I have detailed knowledge of human anatomy. It makes you more prefer a killing machine. Yes.
I have detailed knowledge of human anatomy. And if you cut all of the flesh off of your forearm, just staple it back on, it'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah. This is the muscle just like grows back together. It's how that works. They get out of there and get in the car and are driving away. And the T-1000 has the helicopter, and there's a big dramatic thing with the helicopter going through the underneath the overpass thing. That's an interesting shot. I wonder how they did that. Lots of fun, I'm sure, and not dangerous at all for anyone, because nobody has died with anything involving helicopters in film before. They get through that, and then the helicopter is destroyed, and then he gets a semi truck. Because I'm gonna say that there is nothing that James Cameron likes more in the Terminator franchise than trucks,
flipping
big trucks,
rolling and just otherwise tossing large trucks.
Yeah, because at the end of the first film, it's a truck that the Terminator has, and this one, it's. Starts with a animated transition of a truck grill closing, and then Arnold materializes in his little energy ball and destroys the front of the truck.
It's super cool the way the energy ball cuts a chunk out of the truck back end.
It is far more effective than the first movie, where people just dropped out of the air.
Well, yeah, because you also got the little divot in the ground too. I love that they've got the bright orange glowy like edges to everything, where it's very clearly just like spray paint that kind of like glows a little.
Well, I mean, they just put thought into this being a 3D effect, which I appreciate. Whereas a lesser film might just have them materialized standing on the ground and they're just there. But this actually shows like there's an intersection of what's being transmitted back in time and what is currently existing there on that plane.
Yeah, it does a Boolean.
It's a Boolean, as you say. it is interesting to see that, of course. And when Robert Patrick comes back, there's the one with the chain link fence, which is also nice. So we've got destroyed truck from the first film, then we got destroyed truck from this part, and then we got the truck in the end chase here, which also gets destroyed, and it's full of cryo juice and
cryo juice,
yeah, liquid nitrogen, as it is sometimes referred to on the streets, but the scientific term of course is cryo juice. And they have that go into its Los Angeles steel mill. And
is that up by the Budweiser factory on the 405?
Sure. Sorry. Well, I mean, not really, because they go over a bridge. So I think it's like San Pedro or the Port of Los Angeles somewhere. I will admit to this. This film uses a lot of locations throughout the state of California that are not Los Angeles to represent Los Angeles.
That's not a thing that happens a lot.
No, it never happens. So I cannot say with certainty where this particular steel mill, quote unquote, was, but they do go over a very large bridge, which I assume is the bridge to the Port of Los Angeles.
I mean, you never know, because like the economy was a lot stronger in the 90s, and they closed a lot of those steel factories. People had to find new jobs.
Yeah, they work hard. They play hard. Everybody dance now.
Truck jump scene? Oh, that's where he comes off the thing with the chasing him through the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I completely forgot about the truck that's in the Los Angeles runoff river scene.
It's a semi tow truck. It's a big tow truck.
Yeah. So we have, let's see, by the way, four prominent trucks in the Terminator franchise.
The helicopter/tanker chase was apparently filmed on Terminal Island Freeway in Wilmington, Los Angeles.
Yeah, so that's the port of Los Angeles.
Okay.
Yeah. Terminal Island is what you get to when you go over that bridge thing. And it's full of shipping containers and garbage.
Sure.
And on the other side of that bridge is San Pedro. And, like, if you want to go on, like, a whale tour thing to go whale watching, you can go to San Pedro.
Hmm.
I did that once. My stepmother had a Groupon.
Did you watch some whales?
I watched some whales. But I have to say the whales were kind of boring. The dolphins that chased the wake of the boat were more interesting. So I appreciated that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever gone to any of the locations from this movie? Because they have some very specific addresses on IMDb.
I am sure I have driven by them. I am not the kind of person that specifically seeks out locations like that. Except for the one time when I was in Venice and I wanted to go to where they shot the scene of Indiana Jones coming out of the sewer grate in Last Crusade.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Austin Land, Venice, California. There.
Oh, no. The other Venice.
Nothing's going to get you down there, right?
The less famous Venice. No,
this is where Cobra jumped his 54 Chevy over the canal.
Seen all that garbage. Yeah. I've walked through the canals of Venice. It is a tepid mosquito land or something. I don't know. It's not entirely pleasant. I will tell you that. The canals are not enticing.
No, not at all. Apparently, the Federal Bank where John Connor hacked the ATM is on Roscoe Boulevard in Van Nuys.
Oh, that's fascinating. can we talk about hacking ATMs for a second?
Sure. You just stick the card in there, and then you run an algorithm that checks for PIN numbers.
That's not how any of that works. But that sets up the moment in the scene in Cyberdyne where he's able to do exactly the same thing. Because he brought that with him through the entire film. But whatever.
You know, there was a time where credit card numbers and expiration dates were linked in a way that you could figure those things out. But
it wasn't by
anymore.
brute force sequencing things. That
no,
wasn't,
it was
no.
Definitely not by a method of some sort of little calculator doodad guy. Yeah.
No, that was silly. But they... anyway, so the steel mill, they work hard, they play hard, everybody dance now. They have the liquid nitrogen spray into the place, everybody evacuates. Terminator and friends are in their destroyed little jalopy trying to get away, and T-1000 is chasing after them, and he's being sprayed on by all the liquid nitrogen that is leaking out of his truck.
By the way, when I see that stupid little truck that they stole that doesn't drive very fast, I think of the Pixar truck from Toy Story.
I wonder if that was inspired by this.
I'm going to go ahead and say definitively yes, it was,
mm-hmm.
even though I have no evidence.
Well, who needs evidence? It just really gets in the way of our podcast. The important thing here is that you feel that it's correct.
I feel deep down in my metallic bones that it is correct.
You've got a feeling? Inside mm-hmm. your metallic bones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Electric wavy when you turn it on. But so anyway, they watch as Robert Patrick slowly starts herky jerkying himself and crumbling. It is very effectively shot, even though you know that it is all a bunch of very cleverly placed one-off physical puppet gag things that they're doing. It works in the edit beautifully. And you see what looks like Robert Patrick's feet sticking to the floor and shattering when he goes to lift them off, and his arm, etc., sticking and shattering. And then they shoot him, and then he breaks apart into a bunch of little tiny pieces. And then you get the super fun Mercury shot where you have all the stuff melting and going back together again. Because yeah. it's on a big table that they tilted.
Mm.
So that's how you get the blobs of liquid metal to run into each other.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty good too, the way he blows up when he's frozen and he shoots him. And even though Arnold gives him his fun little like tough guy line, you can tell that it's not shot with the sort of grandeur that would indicate that this is the end of the movie. So you know that this is not necessarily going to be an end. It's a pretty cool scene and. You know, score one for the good guys or whatever, but it's very, very short-lived, and you kind of feel it coming.
Yeah, and it's but not in a Return of the King kind of ending way. Like you don't linger
there's
on
no
it.
No celebratory music, I guess.
No, there's no celebration that they have conquered the bad guy. And then surprise bad guy. You do get this interesting shot of him reassembling himself, and they have to get out of there as fast as they can. You get to see, unfortunately, when they cut from the real liquid metal to the CG liquid metal, it doesn't look remotely similar. But they have Robert Patrick reform, and he goes after them, and he seems to have a bit of a glitch. And that's the only glitch shot that remains in the film, but in the cut material, there's a whole bunch of stuff where they did actual, effects of him, blending into, grating and, black and yellow safety handlebar things that he's grabbing and stuff like that. And most of that was, makeup and physical props.
What now? There's a glitch that made it back in here?
Yes, there's he starts to have glitches being able to hold forms and imitate things, where he is starting to imitate things that he's touching. So there's a part where his hand goes on a railing that is black and yellow, safety striped. And his hand turns black and yellow safety stripes, and he pulls it off, and there are rubber fingers that cling as he's pulling it away from it. And there's other stuff where he's stepping on the grating, and his feet are blending into the grating material. That's all cut out of the film too. So all those glitchy parts are gone. You just get that one thing of that vibration that goes through him. That's still in the film.
I guess I didn't see the vibration even, apparently.
Well, it's a good vibration, but it doesn't make you scream and shout. And they move right on from that to the little end thing here where Arnold is going to hold him off. But we know from prior experience that Arnold, while having a tremendous amount of physical strength, has a finite capability in terms of being able to change his shape and form. So he's no match for the T-1000 in close combat. And he is deactivated and dispatched. And then Sarah Connor is chased, and Robert Patrick's call for him, call for help. And she's like, no, I'm not going to do it. And then he's like, I'm going to hurt you and stuff and things, et cetera. And then John Connor comes upon his mom, and it's not really his mom. It's the Terminator. And he's just like, oh, crap. I know it's not you, and his mom shoots him in the back, and then stuff.
And yeah, it's all about that that one extra round that she dropped that would have put him over the edge there. Also similar to the way Arnold dropped one of his little grenade guys in the back of the truck.
Uh-huh, but he got all the good stuff, because he comes up on the little thingy, because his rerouted power lets him hold on to the little, wench cog thing, and then he's up there and he shoots the T-1000, and he turns into an interesting Stan Winston flayed metal puppet thing, and then gets
that's pretty cool. I like the way he looks there, but Arnold's rerouted power does not apparently give him the power to appropriately hide his real arm behind his back when he comes over that thing, because it's pretty clear.
There's one really bad shot where he's he's hopping or jumping or something, and you can totally see there's the entire bulk of his arm that he can't hide behind his back, and it looks like he's the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
He has very large arms. What are you gonna do? He's a tough guy.
He's a big man. There's nothing you can do about that. But the T-1000 falls into the molten steel mill steel and starts dissolving into everything he's ever been. This, of course, is some very illuminated water, because
it looks pretty good, though.
Yeah, you can't really just put people into magma.
Right. But it would also probably be a little bit more viscous, but, he's thrashing about pretty good.
Yeah, again, this is also kind of slow-mo-ish and weird, because they're cutting in between all these different... They're doing morphs, digital morphs, between... his different forms that he had taken throughout the course of the film. So you see, of course, the foster mother again, and you see the security guard, and you get, of course, Robert Patrick's different gear. He finally dissolves into this thing that sort of looks like lead, and then starts breaking down into a face that turns into another face in a fractal kind of a way, and then he's destroyed. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing that I think my absolute least favorite thing about this movie, in terms of things that should be cut out, is after Arnold shoots him and knocks him into the fire, he says, "I need a vacation," because he's all beat up and like missing an arm and screwed up and stuff. Like, I don't know where that line came from. I don't appreciate it. Doesn't make any sense. Get rid of it.
Well, it came from the cutscene where they watched Lethal Weapon. But anyway,
I'm getting too old for this.
That would have been funny, but so anyway,
yeah.
The T-1000 is destroyed, and then they chuck the Terminator bits from the first movie into the molten stuff, so it's destroyed, thus delaying the creation of Skynet. And Arnold is like, "No, there's still one more chip," and he points at his head, and he's like, "And now I know why humans cry." And he gets on his little thingy, and he's like, "I cannot self-terminate."
Yeah. Edward Furlong protests a lot, mm-hmm. Because he really likes his new friend. I wonder if it's like...
Dan, let's stop you right there. Mm-hmm. He does not protest enough. If anyone had a killer robot friend who loved them as much as this Terminator loves Eddie Furlong, I wouldn't, you know, it's like, how could you just be like, "Yeah, just go into the magma."
He doesn't love him. He's just protecting him.
Yeah, same thing,
I guess. I was just going to say it's akin to, like, when you buy a new iPhone and then you get it all set up properly and then you suddenly discover that it has, like, a manufacturer defect and you're like, "Oh, God, I have to go swap this out and get a new one, but I just finished setting it up with all of my preferences the way I like."
But he doesn't even get a new one. It's all done.
Yeah, it's even worse than that. It's mm-hmm. like, well... it's broken. I need to throw it in the magma, otherwise the world is going to end.
It's worse than that. You're going to be replaced by Nick Stahl. And there's... anyway, so we'll talk about that in a second. But they have the end where it's cheerful goodbye to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and we get the thumbs up as he is burned alive in the liquid metal and destroyed. And you know, now they know the future is, you know, not set and et cetera. It ends. There is another scene where they had flashed forward to like 2029 in the future, and they were at a park, and Sarah Connor in old lady makeup is sitting there watching people at a park in their future overalls and stuff. It looks very strange. It is an incredibly odd scene. I'm very glad that it's cut out of the film. It is like Demolition Man future kind of a stuff.
It's the realization of the sort of dream that she was having, but like they're not all being burned alive, I assume.
Right, like they're in the future now, and Skynet never came to be, and everything's fine. But James Cameron,
like, look at us here in 2029 at that park where we were burned alive. Everything must be fine now.
Yeah, apparently James Cameron felt like it was silly to have that ending. That like the future is not set in stone, so they can't like put a finite thing on it. So he didn't want to have it. I would say. It also looked ridiculous, so I'm glad they cut it out because it didn't look good. It was not a good scene. If you feel differently, go watch it because you're wrong. The scene's not at the end of the film. And then you get the music again, the theme of the thing, and we're done.
Much better themes here. So,
Brad Fidel, like we said, like he has a memorable Terminator score. Theme that he does, and then in the first film it was all electric noise the rest of the time, and then in this one he does a much better job of making something that is a coherent score for the action that is occurring. I don't find it listenable without the rest of the film happening, so I'm not gonna like be like this is my favorite jam, but it is a significant improvement over the first film.
Yes, I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. I was just gonna say, so we blew up Cyberdyne. We've postponed Judgment Day. Were we intended to think this was the end? Like, in 1991 were they like, job well done, you know, wash our hands clean of this franchise?
I have absolutely no clue. Obviously, James Cameron wasn't done with it because he volunteered to revisit it for the Universal Studios Terminator 3D experience. So
was there an associated explanation in the 3D ride about why they didn't actually succeed?
Yeah, because it was a continuation of things that had happened in this film. So it's not, how should I say this? I don't think James Cameron necessarily felt like he was going to walk away and call it a done deal. Even though he had written it originally as having walked away and it was a done deal that they had saved the world.
He's just like, I can retcon this anytime I feel the need because look at all these loopholes in my logic.
Also, he's James Cameron, so he can do whatever he wants. And he does. But the Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines, I don't know the entire story behind what had occurred and it occurring the way that it did, but it is awful. It is not a good film, and it's directed by someone who is not at the level James Cameron was in 1991. It's really just not competently put together or manufactured well. We see no one but Arnold reprise any role. John Connor is replaced by Edward Furlong to Nick Stahl, in that one. I'm assuming, without reading a lot of stuff, that that was mostly because Edward Furlong was going through some stuff at the time, because Edward Furlong, unfortunately, was, like many child stars, he had a little bit of a rough time dealing with what has transpired in his personal life during the time period where he was a child. And notably, that came from Terminator 2, where he married his stand-in, who was 10 years his senior, eventually, after this, and they started seeing each other when he was 13, and she was 26. So that was gross, and weird, and strange, but that was apparently a thing that he had going on, and he apparently continues to have some issues going forwards in his life, and it's pretty sad. But he has nothing to do with the Terminator franchise after the 3D experience. He's completely replaced for everything else you see afterwards. There's a different John Connor in Salvation. There's a different John Connor in Terminator Rise of the Machines. And there's a different John Connor in whatever the F it is in Genesis. And presumably, whatever they do with the new Tim Miller Terminator will have a different John Connor as well, even though Linda Hamilton's going to be back.
Yeah, I forget. We don't see future John Connor in Terminator 1, do we?
No, we don't. We see bits of the future stuff, but we don't see John Connor specifically. The first time we see John Connor is at the start of this film where we get the guy who's got the scarred face.
Yeah, well, that seemed to be a pretty consistent theme amongst the future John Connors. They all have to have scar faces.
Yeah. Say hello to my little Terminator friend.
But you've seen Terminator 3?
Yes, yes. I have.
And if I recall correctly, spoiler alert for people, Terminator 3, I don't know why you would care.
No one cares. It's fine. You can't. It's unspoilable. It's bad.
Don't they go all the Skynet was in the cloud all along kind of bullshit?
Yeah, they basically say like it's just inevitable that it was going to happen. It's just a matter of timing so that, you know, it occurs anyways, which is also something that basically the Terminator 3D experience did too, you know. So it's
was it just like you blew up Cyberdyne, but like duh, they have offsite backups or something?
Well, no, it's just that you didn't completely derail the process that would have produced this, because theoretically Skynet came from somewhere in the version of the future that ended up having the original Terminator and Kyle Reese sent back. There was a Skynet from some source. Of course, that it's in the same bootstrap kind of paradox as the John Connor thing, because where did his dad come from? I guess it was inevitable there was always going to be John Connor. But,
You could say just like it was inevitable that somebody was going to invent an AI that was smart enough to assume humans should die, but I feel like in many of those scenarios, it would not be called Skynet, and it would not make Terminators and then go back in time and stuff.
But I seem to remember something about the third film where the Terminator that goes back in time is also capable of interacting with the Skynet of the present.
Yeah, I think I do remember that. Yeah. It's like, hello, mother, I am here now. And you're, it's like, welcome, complete your mission.
And there's also the interaction of in Salvation, of that whole thing, as you said, Helena Bonham Carter. So anyway, Terminator franchise.
Salvation is playing the long game. It's like, oh, we're gonna get this guy, and then we're gonna make him. We're gonna make a real, like, a super good infiltration drone.
So ridiculous.
And you didn't even know that you were doing. You thought you were doing this on your own, but you didn't even know you were doing it because we told you to do it.
So bad.
It's like a triple turns out.
I mean, the best thing about Terminator Salvation is you get the audio clip of Christian Bale yelling at the lighting guy.
The lighting guy. Shane Hurlbut, the DP.
Yeah, well, I'm going to call him the lighting guy because he was just fiddling with lights while...
He was fiddling with lights while Christian Bale was trying to act. Yeah, don't do that, kids.
No, don't. I mean, I will say, of course, Christian Bale, by all accounts, seems to have some intensity about him when it comes to his profession. But yeah, no, don't just generally do that, even if somebody seems a little more laid back than him.
You gotta lock it up, man.
Mm-hmm.
That means no moving.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're in the eye line of a very important actor who does dramatic things.
Yeah.
Anyway, Terminator 2 is a really good movie.
It is, and it makes me all the more sad about what came afterwards.
So sad, like... It's so sad and angry that you want to, like, go back in time and kill everyone who was involved in greenlighting the sequels.
That's what I mean. It's a little harsh, but
a little dramatic. But, like, you know, you understand the temptation. It is so hard to resist the temptation because this universe and this storyline is so cool, and you could do so many different things in it, but you just really shouldn't.
Yeah. Oh, I mean. No, I mean, you can. Okay, you can. Except, here's the thing. You just can't suck at it. That's the problem.
How do you make a sequel to Terminator 2 that doesn't suck?
I mean, okay, you could have done what Terminator 2, what Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines did. You could have done that.
Which is to say, all right, fine, we can't kill John Connor because he's off the grid and we're hiding. Let's go kill everyone else who was John Connor's friend.
You could just have that sort of thing of it, the inevitability of it occurring, and that being a plot point.
So rather than having another time traveling robot, just deal with the fact that, all right, Judgment Day, here we go.
Yeah, or, you know, I mean, it's tough because the Terminator franchise feels grounded in 1 and 2 because the world that you're in is of the era that it is, and you can't necessarily show the world be destroyed because now you're in a completely fictional place that you're not in, in our reality as the audience. So it's not as interesting to watch, I don't think.
I guess part of it is like the future is so bleak, like it's an unwinnable situation, so you wouldn't want to live in the future where, like, the war is occurring, because, like, you're just gonna die. Like, it's a time game, right? Like, your only options are send somebody back in time, or, like, I don't know, maybe they could do a story about, like, when Skynet first made the first Terminators, because, like, when there are no robots to do the brute force, like, how did it make the first robot that then could make more robots, kind of crap?
Or how did it make the first time machine? Was that a human invention that it appropriated from somewhere else? Is there a whole story with time travel that would be interesting to explore there?
Somebody should check out Genesis.
No, not this guy. There are things that you could do, is what I'm saying. Is like, it is theoretically possible. The problem, I think, is that you just really have to bring your A game and not suck at it, is what I'm saying.
To resist the temptation to do all your winks and nods.
Yes, because, like, what James Cameron did here with the editing, like we've pointed out, when you go back and you talk about what's not in the film that was actually written, shot, with oftentimes effects and makeup and everything, like really time consuming things that occurred. The restraint that was shown in, like, no, you know, I have to kill the sacred cow now. Like, this can't be in the film because it's going to make the film product that will be in theaters lesser. Like, that kind of ruthlessness, I guess, with your own stuff, where you're not too precious about what you've made, is, I guess, appropriate. Because had James Cameron put together exactly what he had written and shot and filmed and put that out into the world, I am not sure it would be as interesting, because we had talked about there is some very broad comedy that made its way into that. There is also, as he has described it, a flabby middle of the film, where he didn't like what was basically happening in the second act once they escaped the mental institution, but before the raid on Miles Dyson's place. He felt like there was just too much, like, boring stuff that was in the middle, so a lot of stuff got cut from there. And, you know, you got your otherworldly, like, Kyle Reese dreams that didn't need to be in the film. That was a regression of Linda Hamilton's character, Sarah Connor, because she's put back into the place that she was in the first one, where she doesn't want to be responsible for this stuff and is sad that Kyle can't be with her right now. Also, it was shot with some strong backlights and like foggy set, so it looks like, you know, God is visiting her, which is a little weird. But
I guess it's a little easier to resist some of those things, because he does have his like gratuitous action movie shots where it's like you've got your slow-mos, you've got your very dramatic like Arnold pointing the gun like kind of like right off the edge of the lens, and you're doing your slow push with the dramatic lighting, and you've got your really cool like badass action movie looking pieces, but they're not just like Terminator universe wink and nod.
Yeah, there are some winks and nods with like, you know, lines and stuff like I'll be back and things, but
get out of the helicopter, that was pretty good. That's yeah. Just like, but it can be written off as just like, that's just like computer's quickest way to say I want you out of this helicopter because I have things to do, like
get
that's just
out.
Yes.
Also not great lip sync, but good for the era, I guess, considering nobody was doing it. But considering the way that he dispatched basically everyone else instantly, it seems a little reserved. But yeah, the larger point is that there's nothing in here that is too broad or weird, other than, of course, your vacation line that you hate. And you can totally buy into it. Whereas I feel like Terminator 3 is too broad and too weird, and there's a lot of stuff you cannot buy into at all that is occurring. And Salvation is an attempt to be very serious about things and very gritty and very real in a very bleak landscape. But we cannot find that particular setting interesting. Also, Helena Bonham Carter is very distracting. But it's
also because it takes place in the future, so it's not rooted in, like, let's hang out in the suburbs of Reseda and then see how the rest of this unfolds for our characters. You have nothing to, like, grab a hold of in that movie.
Yeah, also, there's no, like, you know, how can we get people to believe, and, like, what do we do? Like, how do we hide? And, you know, there's none of that kind of stuff. It's all gone because, of course, everybody believes it's machines that are killing people because that's the future. I there's problems with that. And then Genesis I have not seen, as we had discussed, so I don't even know the total depths of failure that are inside of it. But
I've seen it and I don't even remember.
That's one of the really, I find, damning things when you talk about a truly bad film. When you cannot remember exactly what you didn't like that was in it, only that you didn't like it, that the actual moments of what was bad about it have completely evaporated from your brain because they were so forgettably terrible that it doesn't even stick with you. Like, there are movies that I find that are bad that I remember very vividly, or movies that I don't like that I remember very vividly, but my vivid recollection of that is at least something to recommend that film by, I suppose, as opposed to other films like Terminator 3 and Salvation, where it's like, I completely forget what is happening in the scene. I have no idea what's going on, because it is it is it it didn't even have the capability of leaving an impression on me as a human being.
But this time, the Terminator's a lady. Mind-blowing.
Boob joke. Remember that?
Boob joke? No, I don't.
No, she looks at the billboard, and there's an underwear model or something, and then her chest inflates.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
Oh, well, like we were saying, things that are bad that are burned into your memory. That one's burned into my memory, and I hate it. So, thanks.
Anyway, this movie's good. You should just watch this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Just watch this one and then skip the rest, including, I would say, the 3D one, because we cannot remember the details of it, so it must not have been that great.
we were children. You can't really buy that on iTunes, I don't think.
Children have terrible tastes and things. But yes, T2, Judgment Day. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Great. It's good.
Do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good movie. Is that a kazoo?
No. I just put my hand over my mouth. But anyway, the end.